and we are burning down the house. Last week, welcome to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. This is Burning Down the House, and I am Curtis B. Wayne, your host. Brought to you by Hearst Ranch, grass-fed, grass-finished beef from coastal California, the finest beef imaginable. 153,000 acres. That's 10 times larger than the island of Manhattan. It's spectacular. Amazing. We're continuing our conversation with students from the Cooper Union for the Advancement of Science and Art, my alma mater, talking about student interests, passions, and eloquence. First up. All right, now where's my cheat sheet? We're going to talk about the Farnsworth House. Who's that?
That's me.
All right. Introduce yourself. Get close to the mic. Just pull it on over.
Put the chair over.
Yeah, okay. We're going to do a little Chinese fire drill here.
Hi.
Give us your name, rank, and serial number, soldier.
My name is Danny.
Danny.
Wills.
Wills.
I'm and a you're third year.
Third year. Very good.
Where are you from?
I'm originally from Ohio.
All right. Buckeye.
Yep.
Make your presentation about the Farnsworth House by Mies van der Rohe, and why is it eloquent?
Well, I think the Farnsworth is an example. And
if you could come a little closer, that would be great.
I think the Farnsworth is almost an example in what I define as eloquent buildings. Almost the buildings that themselves have a conversation with nature or the built or nature or the environment around them.
Right, because in the case of the Farnsworth building, it's a white painted steel pavilion
exactly in
a floodplain.
Mm-hmm.
Go on.
And basically, it's surrounded by 306 degrees of glass, and you are in nature. And every photograph you see of the Farnsworth House, you see it through the four seasons. You know, there's either you know white snow covering the whole thing, and it just blends in with the landscape. Or there's the brown leaves on the ground, and I just feel like that is one example of a modern house that has an eloquent way of speaking with the landscape.
Do you think it's a modern house? You don't think that it's something outside of the modern movement, perhaps?
I don't know that
a Greek temple might be outside of the era of Athenian democracy.
I don't know exactly where to place it in the timeline of I guess the history of architecture.
Of eternity.
Yes. But I mean,
speak more about eloquence. What I mean, so it's a man-made structure and it's in nature. So what? What makes it different from a Cotswold cottage, for example?
I think because the focus of the building is its relationship with the nature. And I could cite another example, which is the Villa Savoie. By Le Corbusier, which basically
also a white structure that sits
also
in
a
the
white
meadow.
Structure that sits in the meadow,
mm-hmm.
Is almost lifted off the ground, and the focus of the building is almost your movement through the building through this magnificent ramp that sort of cuts through the center, and then the end point of that path is a window that focuses outside to the landscape which the house sits in.
And so that it sits in opposition to the landscape makes it eloquent?
Well, I think it sits there with respect to the landscape.
Some would say that if it's respecting the landscape. And please, you know, as I mentioned last week, please speak up, classmates. You know, you can say, yeah, that's a crock of shit. I defy you. You think the eloquence, it respects the nature because why? Because it's not attempting to replicate the nature around?
I think there's a lot of architecture today, for example, that you see where they're getting a lot of inspiration from nature and maybe the way the golden section where things are formed very geometrically and mathematically precise as you see in certain maybe seashells in nature. But I think that's the wrong way to go about it. It's not taking lessons from nature and applying it to a building. I think it's just your conversation with what you're building in.
Expand that. Your conversation with what? What? That you're building in an otherwise totally unprepared landscape?
Because you could put up a shelter and it could completely block out everything that's around you, and it's only centered in on itself. But I think a successful, eloquent building is one that it fits within. It shelters the human, but it also fits in with the landscape in an almost natural, I guess.
This is Professor Rod Knox, the as we said last week, the leader of this gang, speaking up. Come closer, Rod.
The Tugendhat House comes to mind. Mies did that. Mm-hmm. And it's totally livable. I mean, the house has an entire wall of glass that you can crank it up like a car door
window.
And you're out, you know, you're really out there in the open. And it on one side, it looks like there's nothing. There's just a wall from the street. You have no idea that this thing is really addressing this landscape. And it's done by the same architect. One is completely livable. It even has a little greenhouse built into the the house. But it's really comfortable. You have a dining area, you have a kitchen, you have closet space, you have all these things. And I think that, you know, he was doing architecture.
Well, let's not get into a discussion here of, you know, which building is more genius. But I want to go back
I mean, which is more, because he's talking about the object in a landscape, but, as opposed to saying, well, that doesn't really make architecture,
If I could step back a little bit and say, what's missing from today in architecture is that's, I think, if you see a house, you know, I think this doesn't apply to every single source of architecture. There's urban architecture, there's the rural architecture, and these small houses, which I'm, I guess, citing examples from.
Let's stay on topic with Dr. Farnsworth's house, though.
And I think in that example, if you see houses going up today, though, in the same example where they're, you know, somebody buys a plot of land in outside of Detroit, and they want to build a house, I think architects treat the way they do their design different today, which what they're missing is this relationship with nature.
Well, that's why we led off with Gimme Shelter, because, you know, it's shelter. Farnsworth is shelter almost at its minimum. But I want to talk just for a brief moment about the difference between the Farnsworth House and Philip Johnson's glass house. Both use nature as a screen, and they're entirely exposed, and yet at the same time, because there's nobody out there as there would be in a suburban development, you don't have a need for solid walls for privacy because you're in nature. It's the same as just taking a shower naked, you know, out in the wilderness. Yes.
Well, there's something different between the two houses that I think the glass house doesn't do that the Farnsworth does. Is that Farnsworth is lifted off of the ground.
Yes.
And the glass house sits on the ground and has this, I guess, hulking roof.
Did you have something that you wanted to say?
Yeah.
Introduce yourself again.
I'm Catherine Bajo. I'm third year architecture. I always have the same argument with one of my classmates in the studio about if Mies is a classicist, and he believes that Mies is a classicist, and I disagree that he is. And I feel as though the Farnsworth House isn't a part of the landscape at all. I feel like I once heard one of my professors say that all great architects are humanists, and I don't feel like there's any modern architecture that maybe, like, I guess nature or the environment.
I think you should study Alberti, you know, his church, especially in that on Piazza in Florence, and we consider Alberti a humanist, because the proportions of Alberti's facade of this, and it escapes me, but I will put it up on the companion blog, is the proportions that he uses are related to the golden mean, mm-hmm. which are then related to the scale of, granted, in the 1500s, a human figure. Mm-hmm. And the and I think Kurt Ackerman, K-U-R-T, Ackerman, wrote about architecture in the age of humanism, which was this much brooded about concept at that time in the Renaissance. Mm-hmm. And I think you should have some look at that.
But isn't, of course, the golden triangle or the golden rectangle is found within nature, yeah?
Someone say.
Through mathematical extrusion.
That's what I'm talking
by,
about.
By looking at the Fibonacci series, 1, 3, 5, 8, 13, and if you spin those coordinates around, you will get a spiral like that of a nautilus or a whelk shell.
Well, isn't that man...
That is a human construct.
Right.
Yeah, that is our perception. That is our invention that we have seen these proportions. But back to Farnsworth, because we only have a couple more minutes. Would you like to speak to the eloquence of the structure itself, other than just as an icon?
Well, I think the eloquence that it has, if we also compare it to Philip Johnson's glass house, is that it's picked up off the ground off these six or eight columns.
Stumpy pilotes. Yeah. That's Corbusier's term for columns that are sort of pilings.
Yeah. And I think the design was driven by that the respect to the landscape, because he knew, I think, that it would flood. And so by lifting it up, and I just think the minimal effect you have on the ground and the little pipe that takes all
the umbilical cord
that takes all of the
sits lightly upon the landscape
and it's painted black to disappear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
he really wanted that a floating glass capsule hovering over the landscape.
But I don't feel that any of those issues really deal with inhabitation. It really just deals with, as I guess as you would call it, the it is an icon, yeah. And I feel like that is sort of the argument against Farnsworth House's being eloquent. It's eloquent in the way it deals with materials and the way it responds to nature as an object. But I guess in terms of what I felt Catherine may have been trying to say about architecture needing to be humanist, it doesn't necessarily respond to man in nature or man
or the human condition of living in that house.
But can we talk about the original idea for the house? What did the client originally want? Was it a house to live in?
We have 2 minutes.
Was it a house to, you know, have these parties in?
Yeah, but you can't have a party in a house with no ventilation. So even, I can actually see, if it can't work for one person, it certainly can't work for, what's a party for you when I have a house like that, 20, 50 people? I mean, it's outside. It's a summer house. It's really a house to look at. The furniture... You know, I have a bad back, and I got that bad back because I saw a Mies chair.
Professor Knox, I think you're grandstanding.
No,
let's...
I sat on it because I thought I was sitting on something soft, and it was hard as a rock.
Yeah, well, that's German comfort. It's like seats in a really
no
good Mercedes.
No human comfort. This guy doesn't care about human comfort.
All right, for me, what is eloquent about Farnsworth is the precision.
Mm-hmm.
It's like clockwork. It is so precise. And so, Jack, would you cue the music, please?
Of course, that's what it's really about.
Let's go out and it can be seen.
two of part two, Architecture and Eloquence from a Student's Point of View. Next up, the Schroeder House in Utrecht by Gerrit Rietveld. Introduce yourself.
My name is Rolando Vega, and I'm a third year at Cooper Union.
Speak.
So I want to go back to the Farnsworth House before I talk a little bit about the Schroeder House. And I guess for me, what's interesting is that architecture does have, that's one of the problems with the Farnsworth House, that it doesn't actually function as a place to inhabit comfortably.
I like to think of it as a really classy deer blind.
Yeah.
Except you can't open the window to shoot the Bambis, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. But I think what it does aim to do, and it does really well, and architecture for me has to properly shelter us, provide comfort, a place of a sanctuary, almost.
That's why we played Give Me Shelter on the way in and on the way out last week.
Yeah. But it also, I think, there's a component of poetry almost in architecture. Architecture has to reveal to us something about our world and enrich it. And I think
sometimes that's done through contrast.
Maybe.
Like in cooking, you know, without the seasoning, a really wonderful wild turkey that you bagged and hung and then dressed and cooked without the seasonings, it would just be a gamey old piece of bird.
Yeah, know? I mean, anybody really can build a building. Most buildings built today aren't built by architects around the world. People just build walls, right. A roof.
Sure.
So, and they live in there. In their houses,
and
comfortably
they have
to an extent, and they have
now,
shelter.
Let's talk about the Schroeder House in Utrecht, which stands in really stark contrast to its neighborhood.
Yeah, well, what I think the Schroeder House and the Farnsworth House have in common, though, is that they reveal to us space. And what I mean by space is that space is, for me, infinite. It's ephemeral. It's almost a ghost. So we build architecture and space. Space is where we enter. We enter into this ghost that's around us that we don't see. And the Farnsworth House...
Well, I would hope that we would see the building that you would...
You would see the building, but the space is what you inhabit. And to me, the Farnsworth...
And it's
beautiful,
what you feel when you're within the structure.
Yeah, and what's beautiful about the Schroeder House and the Farnsworth House is that these components come together and they almost hover in space. In the Schroeder House, it's composed of planes, vectors, all these coalesce in this moment where you feel the friction and the energy of the space inside.
Contained within
that.
Yeah.
I was recently in Chicago and I saw a sketch by Mies and I was blown away by the sketch. It was, I'm not sure of what, it didn't really specify on the detail, but it was a grid.
Was that at the architectural collection at the Art Institute, or where did you see this?
Yeah, it was at the Art Institute.
Yeah, that's a really great resource.
Yeah, it's beautiful. The sketch was basically a grid. So he maps out the Earth, the world, where we stand, and placed on that grid were these beams. And on top of the beam, there wasn't any outline of a roof. There was only, he almost scribbled these lines on top of the beams. And it was, to me, it was the energy of that infinite space coalescing for a moment and allowing that roof to materialize. And that's what I think Schroeder House does as well. Space.
You do a lot of meditation, don't you?
I'm starting to, I think. For me, I think it's when architecture allows you to perceive the world around you and be aware of the world around you in a more, in a deeper way, I think then that's when architecture begins to operate truly at its most powerful.
Well, let's get back to Schroeder. You know, Schroeder is a 3D collage. And,
yeah.
And everyone likes to talk about Gerrit Rietveld and Piet Mondrian in the same breath, almost. Because they're all part of the same artistic movement of Die Stijl, which means the style in Dutch. And it's like giving, to me, it's like giving a finger to the neighborhood. I mean, it's, and I made a pilgrimage to Utrecht just to see it, and it's shocking. It must have been incredibly shocking because, I mean, architecture is a willful act. And I mean that as architecture. Building is of necessity. Architecture is a willful act. Are you being rude? Are you being polemical? Are you being political? Or are you, elevating the public good through this act of architecture? I'm not so sure. Now, the Schroeder House may be eloquent in its internal space.
But the thing to keep in mind with those two houses is you had two the clients were both women, and one woman was intimately involved in the planning of the house, and the other gave him a blank check and said, "I'm moving in as soon as you give me a buzz," and she shows up and she says, "Oh my God, I can't deal with this."
Who can deal? Dr. Farnsworth?
Dr. Farnsworth was shocked.
Yeah. Well,
and surprised, but she told him to do whatever he wanted, and that's what she got. And usually, when you have a female client, she gets involved. A man will give you, will pay you and give and go on a cruise and come back and get the key.
Well, I think the Schroeder House is more successful than the Farnsworth House because of Mrs. Schroeder.
Yes,
the Farnsworth House was Meese just being Meese by himself.
Yes.
And Schroeder House, Mrs. Schroeder actually made that house work for her and still allowed Rietveld some room to sort of delve into his...
I'm glad that you brought that up because the best work that I've ever done came out of it being a collaborative process. And that's my experience. Now, every architect has to collaborate to some degree with the client. Some have more artistic or imaginative license than others. But, the Farnsworth would have been better if he'd been reined in by the practicality. And if he'd used some of those tricks that he used at Tugendhat, it would have been a building that he could actually live in.
Well, we talked about architecture as problem solving. And when you're making architecture and you have no problems, you can't do architecture.
That's right. Yeah. Frank Lloyd Wright said that limitations are your best friend.
Yes.
And he's so right.
And when you get a blank check or when students are asked to design something and they're given no program, you can't expect architecture. Because architecture comes from ingenuity. I mean, my God, here is a problem that is a difficult problem, and I'm taking it on.
But let's talk a little bit more about Schroeder. What about the space inside?
It's gizmatic.
I recently did we had to do analysis in school, and I did an analysis of the Schroeder House.
Yes.
And what I found interesting about the Schroeder House is...
One of my favorite classes, analysis, third-year analysis. Go on.
Yeah. Well, what was interesting is that Rietveld actually had to cheat a lot. Not only structurally, because the house isn't actually reinforced concrete, which is what he was aiming to do, but...
Well, there was the budget to have to respect.
Yeah. But it's actually still really just a row house because it's just two floors, and then he articulated the facade, but the actual interior space is mainly just planar extrusions, and the top floor is basically you can open the top floor completely, but all those doors slide on the plane of the floor slide.
And you said that was a sleight of hand.
Yeah,
I think that's brilliant.
Well, the
multi-purpose spaces.
No. I think it's a beautiful
solution. In a yurt. You know, you just or when I was a student, we lived in 15th Avenue, which at that time was a dorm, and there was no privacy, so we hung up bedspreads to create visual separations, and then we had music to create acoustic separation.
Yeah.
And so he does that at the Schroeder House with drapery.
Yeah, well, I mean, it functions very well, and I think that's why the house works, because of Mrs. Schroeder. But I think had Reedville been left alone, that house would have been much more three-dimensional, because that floor slab basically forces the house to act in two dimensions on that plane of the floor slab. And I think he would have broken that floor slab.
And had half floors in between or something?
Something, I think.
So what makes it eloquent? I mean, you know, really...
I think it's eloquent because it's a beautiful balance between the client and the architect, who has an insight into a way of living that really and truly will affect the way that client perceives the world around them.
Well, you know, when you look at the facade, I mean, there's a lot of energy going on there. This is not your typical Dutch house, which is almost inert, you know? I mean, there's sparks going off, you know, there's red lines and there's white planes, and I think there's yellow and blue in there also, yes?
It was also in a constant state of flux. It never got finished, essentially. I mean, and you also have to keep in mind that what you see now wasn't what was there. The landscape, but that highway wasn't there.
Yeah,
you
know, it was at the end of a military, I think, installation. Yeah, and it was farmland.
It was a big span. And so those windows that just dematerialize and the corners disappear, that's what makes it eloquent. It's these things. Yeah. And everything works. I mean, the idea that the sun could sit on the side, they had a little study, and his friends could visit him, and they were on the outside of the building, and he was on the inside, the mail, and everything. You can talk through a phone upstairs. All these little things were little inventions. Everything was folding out and all this stuff. And everything was really very pragmatic. And, you know, he went ahead after that and built that housing project across the street, which is all the things he learned over there.
Yes, there's a lot of that inside, outside, fat wall, thin wall, permeability of structure. But for me, since I am the host and your facilitator in this experiment in new media pedagogy, it's all about the energy that is distilled into that compositional facade. And yet, you can still live in it, and it, you know, if it works as a house and it has that composition, you've made architecture. Let's hear a little.
He actually wanted to build it around a stairwell, you know,
and that would have
core,
been, and that would have been perfect. You know, but instead,
well,
actually,
it does have that core.
Yeah, actually, that spiral energy, that fiery spiral energy, is obvious looking at it from outside. So we're going to take a little break and listen to some contemporaneous music from Stravinsky, The Firebird. Thank you. That was beautiful. That is Stravinsky. And we are here at heritageradionetwork.com. Jack Inslee is our brave and adventurous engineer and producer this evening. And we are brought to you by Hearst Ranch, grass-fed, grass-finished beef. And you know, if you happen to be listening and you're interested in architecture and you happen to work at Goldman Sachs, you can order some of their stuff, mail order through the internet, and it is really fabulous beef. I've had some, and they are a good friend of Roberta's restaurant and of the station, and I encourage you to look at HearstRanch.com. Now, we're talking about, you know, the Schroeder house is sort of a temple to the Schroeder family. And now we're going to talk about a different temple. It's been taken far away from its in situ location. If we can use some big words here.
In situ.
In situ. The Temple of Dendur. Reintroduce yourself, please, in case people just dropped in.
My name is Rolando Vega, and I'm a third-year student at Cooper Union.
So... talk like an Egyptian. Yeah. Let's get into it.
The Temple of Dendur.
Yes. Yeah. What is it?
Well, the Temple of Dendur is now at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And
I didn't ask where. I asked
what. What is it? Well, I think it helps. It helps. For All me, right. I think the fact that it's displaced is really... an important thing with how I think about the
What is it? What is it? Lots of us haven't never heard of it. This program goes all over the planet. And I'm sure people have... Dendur, how do you spell that in English?
D-E-N-D-E-R.
D-U-R. Yes, okay. D-U-R. Well, of course, it was Egyptian, so you know we don't know how to transliterate all of that. Describe it. It's what's it made out of?
Well, it's stone. And what
kind of stone? Sandstone, granite, basalt.
What sure, color is it? It's light brown.
Okay.
What interests me about the temple?
I'm going to give you another leading question. Isn't it just inscribed all over with really fabulous hieroglyphics?
Yeah, beautiful British names all over it.
Graffiti.
Graffiti. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
One thing that I think is beautiful about Egyptian.
And why is it in New York?
Well, I don't know. The Metropolitan Museum acquired it. I'm not sure how.
Okay, well, for the listeners who might be interested as to how an Egyptian... I'm just going to interrupt here. When the Aswan Dam was enlarged in the 1960s and the Nile Valley, where this temple had been located, not very close to the Nile, was going to be flooded and thereafter only accessible to scuba divers, it was decided that it should be disassembled and given to the highest bidder or whoever could most prestigiously display it.
If you can move it, you can have it.
Right, and it ended up at the Metropolitan Museum, where it is now in a very sterile sort of pavilion at the north end of the Met. And it's a temple mostly erected by the Romans, who were rulers of Egypt at that time. And when they describe an inscription... related to the pharaoh, they're really talking about Julius Caesar, because this is about 40 BC. But let's talk about what it looks like and what we feel about it as architects.
Okay, well, Egyptian architecture really has a lot to do with the procession, for one. And you can see the entire temple, really, in that displaced gate. In front of the temple.
It's in two parts.
It's in two parts, yeah. There's a gate, a fully three-dimensional...
Freestanding
gate.
Yeah.
And as you approach the temple, you actually don't approach it the right way when you enter it now, because you bypass the gate, which is a problem. But you enter and you step up through the entrance of the temple, which is another gate, and you look through an opening, a doorway... another gate, which leads you to an inscribed gate on the wall. And in that inscribed gate, there's actually another gate. So there's this collapsing from the completely physical world and physical existence to the metaphysical existence, which was deeply, deeply Egyptian, for one. Because
Layer upon layer.
Yeah. So it was deeply Egyptian because they actually believed that this, in a way, would happen. They would bypass this physical world and enter a metaphysical state. So I think it's completely, to me, connected with the way we would look at the Schroeder house or the Farnsworth house, and revealing this aspect of our existence that's temporal, for one, and in flux. I think we were talking about that before. So it's about this constant awareness of the energy around us, for one, I think. So the temple is a beautiful example of that collapsing.
It's almost like the Stargate portal, what you're just sort of describing too.
Yeah, I think it's really internalizing that idea for an Egyptian temple.
You know, I would like to just disagree slightly. I mean, yes, it's a very interesting structure, but because it's removed from where it was.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a huge problem.
I mean, there should be. I was speaking with my friend Dr. Kavanaugh, who was in Egypt just a few weeks ago, and the Egyptian monuments today that are still in their original location are surrounded by the Egyptian version of strip malls and small children trying to shake you down for money. And there would be the smell of camel dung everywhere. And so this as a sacred object or piece of architecture in that milieu would be perhaps even more sacred and holy as a very severe and revered work surrounded by chaos and horrid smells and all sorts of low-level criminals wandering the landscape. And when we see it in New York, we see it almost like at the end of Kubrick's 2001, where there's a Louis XIV chair in a white room. I'm sure we've all seen that movie. It's an object out of place.
It's an alien.
Out of time, yes. Yeah.
It had nothing to do with pragmatics.
But
right?
You've described very well why it's architecturally eloquent, and I salute you. That it's very good. The precession of spaces and the procession of a religious ritual and a setting for that, and then inscribed with all of the attributes of the religious meaning put in place in stone for all time. And that is something we don't even see in our modern churches. We see that in certainly the Gothic churches with incrustations of statues that tell stories. We see it in the Byzantine churches with their mosaics. But this is all just done pretty much monochromatically in stone, although I think they may have been painted. The paint may have gone away. Now, what do you learn from that? What can you take from that, from the Temple of Dendur, forward into ordering the spaces that you design? Anybody have any ideas here? They're all thinking.
Well, to make a connection between the structure that deals with spirituality, where there is no, there's no limits as to, like the Schroeder house, there were limits. There were pragmatics were, it had to serve a function. Here, this is an altar. This is something. This is a monument.
It's more, but Rod, more than an altar. It's almost like a machine. It's like a machine for purifying the soul as you go layer by layer.
That's just something that is, I suppose a sculpture can do that. Icons can do that sort of thing.
It's not a sculpture. It's not one of your bugaboos is buildings cannot be sculptures to live in.
Right.
This is not for living. This is a holy space for the Egyptians. Practicing their worship of, in this case, it's a shrine to two sub-deities who drowned in the Nile. And then there are also the allusions to the sun god and to Anubis.
But inside a sacred space that you don't have access to.
But I believe you would bring offerings to this temple. Mm-hmm. So you would go through this gate, fully three-dimensional gate,
yes.
And slowly dissolve into the world of the spirits. So you were actually going through that machine in order to reach the level where you could offer something to the spirits. So, I mean, it did have a function.
Me should have told Edith Farnsworth those things, and perhaps the house would have worked. You know, I mean, I accept it as architecture because it qualifies as architecture. But I also think it's easy when you don't have to answer to anything. When you take a formula, because the temple is just following a prescription, and they're all like that. There's nothing innovative about that particular temple. So it's a formula. And
does it matter that it's formulaic? I mean, it is.
Yeah,
it was picked out as being specifically and uniquely worthy of being saved.
Yeah, because it's old.
I think there's something that is in all of the history of human building, something particularly unique about this particular temple. I mean, there it's different from temple at Thebes.
I'm not disagreeing.
It's very miniature. It's very intimate.
Yeah, but it's a lot of work that went into it. It's a lot of labor, and it's not something that a secular condition can. It's not a secular condition. I mean, you can't afford to do.
Well,
that.
I don't know. I mean. Didn't you ever read Bride's Head Revisited? I mean, that family had their own private shrine.
But, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, okay. We can't all afford to have our own private shrines. Although, you know, the Buddhist people frequently have... You had something to say.
You want to say something?
I have a question.
Introduce yourself.
As I did last week.
Yes. Your
Andre,
name again, please.
Andre Spellbrink. Actually, I'm in a pre-K.
Yes.
When you said, you know, I've been in the Met and I've been in over there, and it really struck me. And when you just said it, how can an architect or a museum curator do this temple without a proper entry through the first gate? And that really bothers me.
They have great parties there.
Why do they do that?
Well,
it's a shame. I
have to admit
building.
That I cheated. I did do some research prior to this session, and the sketches made by the British proconsul in 1819 show that there was a forecourt approximately of the size that has been provided at the Met, and that never could you... approach that gate axially from the river valley. You always had to come around into a forecourt and then process through the gate. And it was theorized that that forecourt beyond the first gate may have been a burial ground. So I can't fault the Met particularly for disturbing our received notions of axial procession. I mean, not everything works on the Roman plan of, say, the via of the road of conciliation in Rome that leads you to Bernini's Piazza, that leads you to the steps of St. Peter's, that leads you into the Cathedral of the Bishop of Rome.
Maybe it's also so that actually, since if it's a burial ground, that the ships came over the river, and that's why you have to enter from the river.
Well, again, my research says that historically, in the 1810s, the river was really rather far away. But, you know, the Nile did used to flood a lot, and so it may have been a key for boats to tie up against to bring sacrificial offerings.
I thought about this, about the fact that you can't go through the gate. And in a way, for me, once
directly,
you...
Actually. Directly, actually.
Yeah, directly. Yes. For me, once you've actually displaced the entire temple and put it inside a museum, I thought it might have actually been more proper that you're not allowed to go through that gate. Because I think you're completely disempowering that space.
Oh, it's absolutely too holy for tourists in their shabby clothes to be walking through.
Maybe. I think that it's more
if
respectful.
If they're going through, they should at least, you know, comport themselves in a proper way, or maybe they should walk like an Egyptian. We've run out of time. Cue the music. Thank you.
You think we're going to be able to cover everyone?
Oh, yeah. We have another hour.
All the old paintings on the tomb, they do the sand dance, don't you know? If they move too quick, oh, wait.
Part four of part two. We're going to talk about 41 Cooper Square. Speak up, my child.
Okay.
Who are you?
My name is Angelique Pierre. I'm actually in my fifth year at the Cooper Union.
Congratulations.
Not until I graduate, but almost.
The adventure has just begun.
Yes, I know. I actually wanted to start by defining eloquence, because if I say what I want to say initially, it may sound a little off base. So I wanted to put it in context of truth and beauty. As some of you may know, I took the truth and beauty seminar prior to this seminar. And in trying to define truth and beauty and understand what the link was between truth and beauty and architecture, I think I've sort of found it in eloquence. I feel that if you take this issue of truth, and when I refer to truth, just to put things in context of architecture, truth to materials, truth to program, truth to the requirements of inhabitation, truth to all the problems that make architecture. If you take
spoken
all of
spoken like a true fifth year student. It's all coming together. Let's talk about this building,
okay.
The Cooper Union Academic Building by Tom Main and Morphosis at 41 Cooper Square.
So I'll try and cut to the chase.
I like the preamble. It's good, though. You got it.
Cutting to the chase, I'll say architecturally, it's clearly not eloquent. As students of the students that have to interact with this building, we can say without a doubt that it doesn't function. It doesn't meet our needs.
Really?
It doesn't.
Really? It's really not a good academic building? It's
no, not at all, actually.
We have razzle-dazzle. Razzle-dazzle.
I hope this isn't dangerous for
quiet
us to do.
In the hall, please. Let the lady speak.
I have quite a few classes in there. Actually, we're stuck doing some courses in a conference room, but apart from all that, just looking at it as an object and trying to place these notions of truth, beauty, and eloquence, and recognizing that they are all local notions. And there are quite a few people that are taken in by this building, people that like it, people that find it interesting in it. And it made me think that, in a way, it's sort of socially eloquent, if you think of eloquence as being persuasive. So, I mean socially eloquent in that it deals to a local truth of fashion, of the times. It speaks to a lot of the things that are going on in our times, and architecture is supposed to be a reflection of those things. And I think in that sense...
You think it speaks to our time?
You mean yourself and Professor Knox?
No, I mean all of us in the early 21st century, and our collective experiences, At the end, I'll tell you what I think about the building, but you go on. This is your presentation.
Okay. If you look to me...
I'm buying the social thing, or the Spanish steps kind of thing, although the way that it's carried out, I have qualms, heartburn over. But go on. That's on the inside. Spanish steps and Rome are on the outside. This is topologically inverted, and the Spanish steps are on the inside for you all to hang out and apparently talk to each other sitting on the steps. Do you do that?
No. I've never...
Do you know? Does anybody know anybody who actually hangs
out? I actually see that happening quite a lot in the building.
Okay.
People hanging on the stairs in between classes. Yes.
When do they do that?
I see it.
Mostly in between classes. Mm-hmm. 10 minutes before class starts, everybody's sitting on the stairs, eating their lunch.
I'm sorry.
What do you think about this extruded sort of esophageal tube of fiber reinforced? I mean, in a way, aesthetically, it's a little bit like Borromini, but then it also, at the same time, looks like so much guts kind of interlaced through the middle. Do you find that eloquent? I mean, does it give you things to think about as a student?
Not at all. I don't know what it refers to. I don't know what its purpose is. The issue of the stairs, the only reason I find that people hang out there is because we have no lounge space. Yeah. Right, yeah. We have no place for us to gather.
No cafeteria? No.
Nothing.
That's a programmatic thing. Let's not nail that on Tom Ming. Although he could have been a spokesman on behalf of
the... Who should we nail it on?
George Campbell.
This is true. Nonetheless.
Well, it's not eloquent, but it's socially eloquent. In that it represents a work of architecture that's, as Philip Johnson liked to say, speaking of Mies, it's zeitgebunden. It's locked in time. It's of a certain time. Now, because we're almost out of time, I want to introduce my thinking about this building. This is a rock and roll building. Rock can be eloquent, but it's always about being a little bit rude, a lot about flash, and a lot about motion. So let's cue the out music. Thank you. This has been Burning Down the House. Thank you. This is HeritageRadioNetwork.com. We've been sponsored by Hearst Ranch. That's T-Rex. Bang a gong. Get it on. That's everything about 41 Cooper Square, in my opinion. It's about being dirty, sweet, and I don't know if you're my girl, but it's rude. We were brought to you by Hearst Ranch. Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. We'll see you next week with a discussion of the Omega Institute and the Cascadia Living Building Challenge. Let it roll, Jack. Talking.